Hello. In this audio recording, we would like to talk about the second person that we didn't get a chance to talk about in the previous audio snippet. And if you listen to the previous recording, you'll recall that we talked mostly about Thaddeus Stevens, and how he was a man of radicalism, but it was a radicalism that was justified, and he was, you could say, a counterexample to the policy of moderation that most people follow, and that kind has been, to a certain extent, what a lot of Americans in position of relevance have followed. And which has led to them not fulfilling their calling, not fulfilling what they were put in positions of power to do. And we talked about how judging whether something is good or bad based on how extreme, quote unquote, it looks or sounds, is an invalid parameter, because there are certain things where it is obvious that the right answer is at the extreme of the 0 to 100% spectrum, and that you can't, if you start aiming for quote moderation, you'll always be aiming for 50%, and 50% sometimes can be very, very wrong, because in many cases the right answer is closer to 100% or 0%. And if you try to stay in the middle, then you're just guaranteeing disaster, and you're doing the wrong thing. And as we said, there's a certain kind of inherent metaphysical contradiction in following a policy of, quote, moderation. Because if you are committed to moderation, then you're being extremist about it, because you're saying I'm going to be moderate 100% of the time, and just by that alone, you're violating your own principle, and hence any philosophy that is inherently self-contradictory is not worth its salt. It's not worth following. That's more or less what we talked about the previous time, and we talked about the life of Thaddeus Stevens, one of the greatest Americans of all time, and how he made a lifelong effort to fight for the right thing, but sadly, America was not that interested in that extreme quote unquote solution of giving freedom to black people and ending slavery, not only literally but figuratively. That radical extremist position was rejected by America as a whole, and that's why Thaddeus Stevens felt like such a failure towards the end of his life, that he had fought and fought, not been able to succeed. A man who suffered through a lot, suffered through poverty. We talked about his club foot and how he was, he had a limp his whole life, and was mocked and ridiculed as a child for it. And he suffered a great deal, and I believe he never married or had children. But he had people who supported him, but I can imagine that in many times of his life he felt very alone in his fight for the truth, what he was committed to seeing manifested on earth. So we wanted to talk about him and then contrast him with another person from around that same time period, another American. But before we get to that, we'd like to say several things related in part or in great part to what we were saying in the previous snippet. First is that it seemed as if after we recorded the previous snippet, certain stories came out to immediately bring like a sense of confirmation about what we said about Lahaina. And I know that people say Lahaina, but as we tried to mention before, I believe the correct pronunciation is Lahaina. And the reason why is that it kind of points out the reason why the fire that consumed the, this town happened. And if you're listening to this recording at some point after this story, Lahaina is a town in Maui, in Hawaii, that was practically burned to the ground by this huge fire that came, and it's believed that the fire came as a result of power lines that came down from a storm called Dora that that stayed as a Category 4 storm all the way from the beginning, you could say, of the near the beginning of the West Coast in the Pacific, the U.S. West Coast, and going all the way through to through Hawaii, where Hawaii is, and into the through the international date line and into the shall we say Western Pacific, if you can call it that, and so. This storm down these brought these huge winds into Hawaii. It didn't hit it directly, unfortunately, but it kind of it got close enough to make a lot of impact, and it downed some power lines. That's what they believe, and it sounds plausible, and that and therefore fires started, and it was like a huge fire that just got out of control. And it killed a lot of people. And the thing is that as I was talking about this, I felt a little strange saying this, that, you know, I was happy when I was seeing the numbers of people dead and the number of people growing. And I know that that sounds so evil and so callous and so heartless and so quote, wrong. And we tried to explain what happened is Hawaii was the portal, the porthole through which Old Bastard was, that monster was in, and what came with him, because he as a person is a very, how shall we say, he is he's an empty vessel. There's something about him. He's kind of useless. He's lazy. He's incompetent. He talks smart, and he sounds smart, but he in many ways is a very dumb person. And an empty vessel. So he's, you know, like, for example, if you take like a person like Hitler or even a person like Stalin or someone like that, I mean, you could see that they were the driving force behind what they were doing. You know, evil as they were and all that, there was something in them and they were moving. With Old Bastard, it's kind of different. He is like this, kind of like this, almost like this mannequin that is put there in front, and he moves through, you know, the movement of someone behind him, and he happily does it. But it is, so he is this empty vessel, like the face of a lot of evil that's moving behind him, that he's not even leading that evil. The evil is using him and using him as a prop, as this figurehead to then go ahead and carry out the evil. I don't know how else to explain it. You know, a lot of conservatives think of Old Bastard as like the genius behind all the evil, and they think, a lot of people think that Old Bastard is the kind of the quote president behind the scenes, and that he is, you know, giving instructions to bite me all the time. And people who think like that, I dare say, are deceived, because they're giving Old Bastard more credit than he deserves. He doesn't care. I mean, he couldn't care less. I mean, he'd rather be in the beach enjoying himself. I mean, he already did the destruction that he was called to do, and he just wants to live it up and enjoy his life. A man who had never achieved anything, never did anything productive for anyone ever, and he's a multimillionaire, lifelong career politician, and he's wealthy, incredibly wealthy, at least when compared to his actual achievements. And all he cares about is, enjoying that money and living it up. He couldn't care less about what's going on. But the thing is that he was the instrument through which a lot of evil came into the world. So, and Hawaii is responsible for that. The 50th last state of the Union, and that entered America, became the porthole through which the evil that old bastard represents came into the land to kind of finish out the destruction of the country. They have no mercy whatsoever for the people of Hawaii. Well, no mercy whatsoever. They are getting what they deserve, and they actually deserve even more. And I know that sounds callous, and it's as if these three or four things that appeared online kind of served to confirm what we were saying. And as we said before, lahaina is it's kind of a la means, it's the female form of the definite article the in Spanish. I think even in Italian, I believe it's also the same thing. And hyena, refers to old bastard. Old bastard was a mocker, a constant mocker. You can see it in his face. He likes to mock people and ridicule them, and bring them down and humiliate them. There's a sense of silent superiority and arrogance in him. In it, I sometimes don't think of him as a human. He's more like an animal. So Lahaina is sort of it's a silent pointer to this is why this is happening, because you let the you let Lahaina loose into the American political and cultural atmosphere. You were the porthole, and that's why you're being you're suffering this right now. The first thing that kind of served as a confirmation of that connection was that on that same day that we recorded that posting, August the 12th, the previous posting or recording, a story came out, and I'm going to read from the New York Post. This is a story posted on August 12th, 2023, the day of the previous audio snippet where we talked about Lahaina and all that, and old bastard and all of that. It's a New York Post article, and it says, Barack Obama. Well, it doesn't say, as I said before, I don't say his surname unless I need to for some reason, but usually I just say what his real surname is. So I'm just going to replace what is written here with the real surname. So it says Barack Obastard told X, quote, and this is kind of a gross story to tell. I'm sorry about this, but I just have to say it just to confirm what we were saying about Lahaina. So it says Barack Obastard told X, quote, I make love to men daily, but in the imagination, unquote, letter shows. So it says here, it says something else, but I'm going to correct it to what it really should have said. And as we've said before, the last president of the United States was George W. Bush. Whether you liked him or not, the 43rd president of the United States was the last president this country, this American Republic had. And then on November 5th, 2008, the American Republic died the day we elected Barack Hussein Obastard to live in the White House. And I sincerely believe that that election was not stolen, and that we, the American people, actually voted for that son of a bitch into the White House. It was a collective decision based on white guilt and black people not being on the watchtower and more worried about just having one guy who has you know more the same amount of melanin as they do living in the White House. And they didn't even care that the guy didn't have 1 ounce of former slave blood in him. And that would have been the vindication of the black people who suffered through slavery, who paid such a great price and a horrible price. And that would have been the vindication. A black man, a former, a descendant of former slaves, making it into the White House. But, you know, black people didn't care. We don't care. The son of a bitch was spawned by a radical Kenyan communist, a crazy lunatic leftist, and he was not even full black. He was half black. His mother was white, but black people didn't care. We just want someone who looks like us. Oh yes, yes. And they voted for him. A lot of white people voted for him out of guilt, and a lot of people just got swayed by all his hypnotic persona, and so he got elected. So, but I'm going to change what it says here to what it should really say. Former White House resident, and I like to abbreviate White House resident with you know, W from white, H from H-O from house, and then resident. So that makes it W-H-O resident. And you, if you sound it out, it's Horsident. So former Horsident, Barack O'Bastard, wrote of his own, quote, androgynous mind, and, quote, making love to men daily but in the imagination, unquote, according to the redacted portion of a non-notorious 1982 letter obtained by the Post. So this is from 1982, a long time ago. The more than 40-year-old letter to an ex-girlfriend recently resurfaced after O'Bastard biographer David Garrow gave a long and winding interview on the one-time something. Not going to read that. Let me part of what he said is kind of gross to say it, and I have to read it with a picture of him staring and Michael O'Bastard staring me in the face. But let me just scroll that out of view. Okay. In regard to homosexuality, this is a quote from the letter. I must say that I believe this is an attempt to remove oneself from the present, a refusal perhaps to perpetuate the endless farce of earthly life. You see, I make love to men daily, but in the imagination, unquote, O'Bastard, then 21, wrote to Alex McNear in November of 1982. To be frank, I'm not too quite clear on what the hell he's talking about, what he's trying to say. It is strange, but clearly something was inside of that that son of a bitch. There was something moving. He's a mocker and a blasphemer. He's a person open to things that that defile things, and that's also part of why the La in La Haina is a Spanish definite article, because that's exactly how the Hispanic culture behaves, as we tried to say before. The Hispanic culture is a culture that respects no boundaries. There's a culture of blasphemy that has no respect for things that have a value, an intangible value, even if they are not protected by force. In other words, if something is valuable but is accessible and can be manhandled and abused, then the Hispanic culture says, go ahead and do it. Seize the day. It's a culture where in some of their countries they say if someone does that, they call it vivo. In other words, that's a word for alive. In other words, someone who is slick and can quickly like snatch something and steal it without the other person noticing, they call that alive. So that's how they celebrate life like that. Like that proves that you are alive, that you are with it, that you are that you're quick and alive. So it's a culture of blasphemy, and this guy had that. This old bastard had that in him, and he was like percolating a lot of crazy things inside of him, and that's what so gross, and that's what Hawaii enabled. And they show a picture of this girlfriend that he had, who apparently dated old bastard while they were both attending Occidental College. And she's a white lady. So it says here, my mind, another quote from the letter, my mind is androgynous to a great extent, and I hope to make it more so until I can think in terms of people, not women, as opposed to men. But in returning to the body, I see that I have been made a man, and physically in life, I choose to accept that contingency, unquote. And I'm not going to read more from and more there. And there are some more stupid comments here by from the biographer of Old Bastard. Not going to even read that. But the point is that this letter that surfaced just as the Lahaina thing is happening, and as and on the same day that we curse and condemn Lahaina. And worthy, and is worthy of more death and casualties because of a bastard. That same day, this story came out. So it's like a confirmation of the yuckiness in that guy. And it's weird because we could talk for hours about this thing about the androgynous thing that he's talking about. And the sad thing is that there's this element of reality to it. And that's what Old Bastard channeled. He channeled a lot of things that had a valid righteous flow to them that was supposed to enter the land and bring restoration to it. But it's like it got it's like jujitsu, it just got channeled and redirected, but towards evil. And there was a lot of things percolating in that son of a bitch. And it's as if he was being exposed to things that were good and or principles or flows that were righteous, but they were being taken and being redirected towards evil. It's kind of very long to explain what we'd have to say about the androgynous thing. It's not easy to explain in one recording or two or three. We do sort of vaguely talk about it in some, well, not vaguely, but we do talk about it, maybe not in so much detail. That's what I mean to say. Not vaguely, it is detailed, but not in maybe too much detail in some of the postings where we, on the website where we record, where we post these audio snippets. So if you want to look for the word androgynous, somewhere on that website, you might find what we've said about that before. There is a, there are stages of development in the human being, and it's always like there are stages of transformation. There is a stage of epiphany where you become aware of a principle, a reality, a transformative reality, that maybe most other people are not aware of. That's the epiphany stage. Then you have the stage of conflict, where you start sharing that idea with other people, and then you start creating division because some people will side with you, other people will not. You will be a divider, a person of conflict. You're going to be swimming against the current, like those salmon that swim against the current. And then at some point, then there's a moment of separation, and then you enter into the stage of the wilderness stage, where you're by yourself. You are separated from the structures that still support what is contrary to the epiphany the truth epiphany that you had, and you start growing in that epiphany, but you're by yourself and you're no longer dependent on the structures that were over you as a child, you could say, figuratively speaking, and you start growing in the wilderness. And then you have a final stage of radical sacrifice. That is the fourth stage. And in that fourth stage, then there comes an element of androgyny. Again, it's very difficult to explain, describe. So there, and in that stage of androgyny, it's like there's, it's like female becomes male, male becomes female. And there's this kind of like a blurring of things. I don't know how to explain it, but we do try to explain it in some of the postings, one or two at least, from what I recall, on the website where these recordings are posted. But the thing is that that's the stage of that radical sacrifice. And Obastrid came as we as a nation were supposed to enter into that stage collectively. And so it's like he took that androgyny component and just redirected it into a negative, an evil flow. And America entered into that stage as the 21st century came along. But he was having these things percolating in him back in 1982 because he was being prepared for what it was supposed to do later. And one of the other things that he redirected was the fundamental transformation of America. We needed a fundamental transformation because in that radical phase of sacrifice, that's when you start saying, no, I will not compromise. We are going to have to if we have to raise everything to the ground and burn everything to the ground and start all over again, that's what shall be done. And in that stage of uncompromising radical sacrifice, you will suffer a death, you know, figuratively or literally. And but that death sows the seed for the transformation. So you're not just there to patch things up. You're not put there just to put little band-aids on things or just some caulk and wherever to fill up a hole or whatever. No, you're there to tear down, you know, bring burning down the house, like the song would say. I forget. That sounds like a line from a song, burning down the house. So you have to burn down the house and rebuild it from scratch on a new solid, more perfect foundation. That's what we were supposed to do. And Obastrid redirected that, and he kept talking about the fundamental transformation of America, and it was kind of ironic because everybody, the conservatives, started opposing him. Oh, we don't need a fundamental transformation. They were the same people, the very people who opposed the truth and what would have saved us from the death that is coming upon us in a few weeks. America will be dead in a few weeks, as we've been saying in these recordings. That death would have been prevented if the conservatives would have understood, yeah, we need a fundamental transformation. And the thing is that when Obastrid came and said it, it kind of served as a way to make the conservatives more determined not to have a fundamental transformation, because he was proposing the wrong transformation. He was proposing a degradation or deforming of fundamental deforming of the country, a permanent deforming. Because he wanted to transform the country under a foundation of foreign evil ideas, on a transformation based on truth, and so that's another thing he redirected. And I am I'm saying too much about this. I thought it was going to be like a 2-minute thing, but I think it's important to say, and as I was saying this a moment ago, it just dawned on me. That's why La Hyena got all just blotted out, because it was a figure of what we needed to do with the country. And because La Hyena served as an instrument to prevent the transformation of the country, you know, burning down old structures so that new could be lifted up, then this is the La Haina said was given what it denied the country, and in a, but in a very bad way. So that's why La Haina got razed to the ground, everything burnt down, and wiped out, because it prevented America having that happen in the figurative, burning down the bad structures that needed to be destroyed in order to build up new good things. So that was one confirmation. This letter from Obaster from way back in 82, and that letter was 26 years before before he was elected, and interestingly, if I'm remember, yeah, the letter was written in November of 1982, and I can see they have a picture of it of the envelope. But I wish I could see the exact date. Well, this actually says, yeah, well, I'm not sure. But yeah, I wish I knew the exact date. It says November of 82. I'd be sort of, be interesting if the date of the letter was the 5th of November of 82. That would have been very fitting. But okay, so regardless, the thing is, the second confirmation about what we said about La Haina is that immediately in the news, the story came out about Oprah Winfrey being in La Haina. And I did not look that up before this recording, but let me see if I can find it. Oprah Winfrey. In La Haina, on the 14th of August, the story came out on the UPI saying Oprah Winfrey visits Maui wildfire survivors, and the story that I saw was something about she had like a news crew that was following her, and the news crew was denied access, and that was like a big deal. They were not allowed to enter, and that was a problem. But Oprah Winfrey came into the news, and that struck me deeply because I did not say it out loud. But when I was talking about La Haina last time, I said, Hawaii became this porthole for Obaster to enter the country. The first thing that, one of the first things that came into my head was Oprah Winfrey. And why Oprah Winfrey? Because, as you may recall, that eventually Obaster moved to Illinois, and he ended up somehow, you know, being an incompetent state senator, and then somehow through a story that's too long to explain, there was some sort of there was another guy who was going to be the senator, and somebody leaked a story about him having an affair or something. I don't remember the details, and that kind of brought him down and allowed Obaster to overtake him and win. So he's always been rising through kind of things done on his behalf. He's been like that's why they called him the Chosen One, because he was chosen by evil. And then everybody just kind of rallied around him to kind of lift him up. And they would do whatever was necessary to get people out of the way in very evil ways until they finally got him where he, quote, needed to be, at least for them, to, you know, unleash their destruction. But so he eventually moved to Illinois, and Oprah moved to Illinois. She used to be in Baltimore. I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch Oprah Winfrey on the local news station. She was a reporter for Channel 13, if I remember correctly, WJZ-TV. I think that station is still around in Baltimore. I think that was the right station. And that's why I was surprised later on when she became a national figure. She moved to Chicago and started her Oprah Winfrey show, and you know, got very popular and well known and all that. And then she had a book club, and then she saw something in Old Bastard, and it's like she said, "Oh, this is the guy we need, the perfect guy. He has the looks, the personality. He talks the way you know he needs to talk to become the first quote black president." And so she started kind of like fixating on him, and he had written this stupid autobiography, and she promoted that book on her show, and that kind of automatically turned his book into a bestseller, and that's part of where he has a lot of his money. Apparently, you know, there might be other sources, quote unquote, but at least officially, that's where a lot of his quote wealth came from. And that's when he got kind of lifted up into the national limelight. It was through Oprah Winfrey in Chicago. You know, the throne seat of the matriarchy in America, as we've said before. So she was, in a sense, the porthole at another level to bring him into national prominence. And I kept thinking about her as I was talking. I didn't say her name, but I was thinking about Oprah Winfrey. I kept saying porthole. So Hawaii provided like a physical porthole, and then Oprah Winfrey provided like a social or political porthole. I don't know how to explain it, to further, you know, inject Old Bastard into the American landscape. And lo and behold, Oprah Winfrey, of all people, then suddenly, I had not heard about her for quite a while, because, you know, her show ended a long time ago, or many years ago, I forget how long, but she's been out of the spotlight, and then suddenly she appears in Hawaii, and I saw the headline like 1 or 2 days after the last recording, and to me that was a confirmation, yes, La Hyena is suffering this because it was a porthole. And just to validate that, the Chicago porthole for Old Bastard showed up physically in Maui, in La Hyena, to you know, to supposedly help the people and all that rubbish. So that was confirmation number two. And confirmation number three is something, let me go to that story. It's about something controversial regarding the way that the authorities, in quote authorities in Hawaii, fought the fire. There's been a lot of criticism, and I'm going to read the article here. The title of it, it's on the Gateway Pundit. .com, and it says, quote, "Water requires conversations around equity," unquote. It says, "Meet the radical Obama-loving official who delayed life-saving water to Maui for several hours while the fires were contained." So interesting that they chose out of nowhere to say Obama-loving official. And it's like a confirmation, yes, Old Bastard is the reason for this. La Hyena, in other words, Old Bastard, the hyena, La Hyena, is the reason for what was happening in the town of La Hyena. Let me just read a little bit of that of the article here. "The people of Maui begged for life-saving water from the West Maui stream to be used to fight the fires, only to be brushed off. The Honolulu Star Advertiser reported Wednesday there was an official request made to divert the water, and it was ignored for several hours by Deputy Director M. Kaleo Manuel of the Hawaii Commission on Water Resource Management, Hawaii Commission." "We are also learning some infuriating details about Manuel's background." The paper obtained a letter from Glenn Tremble from the West Maui land company, who dropped some damning details regarding the fire's chronology. The fire was contained at 9 a.m. local time. So it was contained at 9 a.m. local time, but troubling weather conditions and low reservoir levels led them to make the request for stream water to store as much water as possible for fire control. the reservoirs needed to be filled by 1 p.m. Instead, Manuel waited until 6 p.m., and the once contained fire completely exploded. And I think that was also, this was backed up by people on the ground that I heard about, you know, some people saying, hey, we had the fire contained, and then they turned the water off, and we just couldn't continue, you know, containing it anymore. You know, people on the ground who got their houses burned down and all that. Then they keep talking about more details. Let me just skip this. And now here it says here, here is the Obama loving radical in a recent video explaining his woke views on water management. Manuel saves his most infuriating statement at the when water requires true conservation is about equity. And there's a video, but obviously we're not going to play the video. It says here, there's a part of what he said, apparently. You know, in essence, we treated, Native Hawaiians treated water as one of the earthly manifestations of a god. So listen to that. Native Hawaiians treated water as one of the earthly manifestations of a god. And so that reverence for a resource and that reciprocity in relationship was something that was really, really important to our worldview and well-being, right, living in an island and isolated from other civilizations. So I think where it shifted to today or over time is that we've become used to looking at water as something which we use and not necessarily something that we revere as that thing that gives us life, right? And then it says, I mean, this is the guy, the Manuel guy, the Obama, bastard-loving guy. I mean, to me, it's a shift in value set. And if we can start to really look at how we as humans in an island can reconnect to that traditional value set. So really, my motto is always like, let water connect us and not divide us. Like, we can share it, but it requires true conversations about equity. Communist, you know, communist talk. In other words, oh no, we can't have all this water being used in this one neighborhood with a lot of nice houses. No, oh God forbid, or you know, the water God forbid. So you say, oh, you're so evil, saying, oh, you wish there were, you're happy, you know, as the death toll rises. Well, this is the look at these people, you know, crazy people. With this crazy mindset, you know, and this guy who is thinking about water in a in a communistic context and about revering the water, you know, it sounds like Indians when they revere their cows, you know, oh the water god, and let's stay in harmony with the water god instead of seeing it as something we use, like you know, water is a resource we use. No, it's something we are to revere. You know, it's like when an Indian sees a cow, he doesn't see it as, okay, it's something, you know, that we can use for like a burger and a glass of milk or whatever. It's something we are supposed to worship. And I'm not saying that you should mistreat cows or whatever, but, you know, they are living beings, but, you know, there comes a time when they have to fulfill their calling, and their calling, I guess, in part, sometimes is provide hamburgers for people. That's part of their calling. But it, while they're alive, they're to be treated fairly and with dignity and treated properly as living beings. They're not to be mistreated or tortured in any way. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to bow before a cow or just let the cow just stand there in the middle of the street, stopping traffic, and treating it as if it's more than what it really is. So this was like a third confirmation of the connection with Obastor, and what's wrong with the people of Hawaii. A fourth confirmation. So the thing is, this is the official that, and the other thing that that people are saying is that the Hawaii Electric Company should have cut off electricity, so that the power lines would not have, caused any fires, but they didn't. So we're seeing the collective incompetence of the government there, and people who are more concerned about, this fake spirituality, conserving water, the water god, and all this rubbish, instead of actually resolving the issue. So people get what they deserve, and that's what happened in Lahaina. People got what they deserve, and they deserve more of it. And that's why I have no sorrow. No, I feel no sense of sadness. Oh, poor people. No, they got what they deserve. And even as this has happened to them, there is no repentance, no change of mind in them. There's no transformation in them, an awareness. Oh, there's something wrong with us. No. They just double down. And you know why I say that? Because not just because of this Manuel guy and all these other people. They have no remorse. They have no sense of we did something wrong, or we have to rethink our ideology or our way of thinking. No. But there's a comment that I found online, it's a story on again on the Gateway Pundit and .com, and the story basically was about something else. It's the headline is Karine Jean-Pierre. I don't know how to pronounce her name. She's an idiot who was the quote spokesperson in the White House. Karine Jean-Pierre mispronounces Senator Mazie Hirono's name, then calls her a man. And Mazie, maybe I'm also mispronouncing it, but I don't care. Mazie Hirono is the senator for Hawaii in Washington, D.C. And I would not have known that she was a she from her name. So, but the thing is that she's supposed to know. She's talking about her. So, so they mocked her for that. That's kind of what happened. And apparently she was being asked questions regarding the fire in in Lahaina, and she mentioned this stupid senator. She's a worthless Democrat whore, from what I understand. Mazie Hirono, of Japanese descent, apparently. And she called her a man. The androgynous thing happening again. So this is all related, believe you me. This is all related. And what I wanted to share was a comment that I saw made by someone in the article. So someone made a comment, and someone replied to that comment. And this the date of the comment is 14th of August, 2023, at 5:46 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, I imagine. Made by a person whose name I forget, whose username or whatever is Deplorable D. So this person wrote Hirono or KJP. KJP is Karine Jean-Pierre, I think. Hirono or KJP. I asked my sister, who lives outside of Lahaina, how they could elect such a stupid woman to represent them. And in parentheses, it says Hirono. Her answer, colon, there are a lot of dumb people in DC. Trump got elected. And then the person writes, yes, my sister is a crazy socialist. So the thing is, this person has a sister who lives outside of Lahaina. And this person asked her, interesting, I can't say if it's a he or she, the androgynous thing again. I don't know if this person's a he or she, but I asked my sister, who lives outside of Lahaina, how they could elect such a stupid woman to represent them, Hirono. And her answer was, oh yeah, there are a lot of dumb people in DC. Trump got elected. So her response was just kind of like right back at you. Your Trump is an idiot. So you're calling Hirono an idiot? Yes, there are lots of idiots. Trump, for example. So what I'm trying to get at is did the people of Hawaii learn anything from this? And the answer is diddly squat. They didn't learn a thing. They don't deserve any mercy. They just double down on their stupidity and their evil that opened, just like they opened a porthole for America to be destroyed, a porthole, they opened through their actions a porthole for their city, their town, and their island to be destroyed and hit with this horror, the greatest tragedy in Hawaiian history, since, at least since Hawaii has been part of the U.S., either as a territory or a state. So they open a porthole for the destruction of the whole country. Then through their own actions, their attitudes, their thinking, they open a porthole for their own destruction. So I have absolutely no mercy for these bitches and the sons of bitches and these whores. And they're mostly whores. I don't know. There's a feminine thing about them. I saw someone at some point just flipping through the channels being, I stopped it. There was someone being interviewed from La Haina, a lady. And she was being asked about, apparently she's one of the people who survived and had her house destroyed and all that. And she was, and I don't remember the exact words, but it was something like, oh, it was a very soft voice. We're here standing together as a community. And then she started talking. It was, and she was a woman, of course, but there was a certain effeminate quality to it. And you say, oh, well, isn't she a woman? Isn't she supposed to be effeminate? No, she's supposed to be feminine, not effeminate. And there's a difference. It was like this weak, all community. And as we've said before, community is like a code word. It's like when you hear someone saying community, just boom, that's a sign that there's something wrong with that person. Because it's always, it comes with something. It's a loaded term. Well, maybe that's not the right way to describe it. It's a term that is loaded with a whole bunch of stuff. Let me put it that way. It comes with a lot. When people say community, a lot more than the word community comes out of their mouths. A lot of other stuff comes out. It's this communistic thinking, you know, that old bastard promoted. It's this wiping out of the individuality of the human being and just blending into a sea of, like a droplet of water into this big pond. You know, once a drop of water it goes into the pond, into, you know, a reservoir or whatever, it gets lost in it. You know, you can't say, oh, there goes that water droplet. It's gone. It's like it loses its individuality in this sea of commonality. And you could feel it in her talk. It's like they didn't learn a thing, not a single thing, from the fire. That's why, what's the point of having mercy on these people? And she looked like a nice lady, you know, like, you know, those nice, kind ladies. But the sad thing is that kindness is a destructive, quote, kindness, because it just emasculates you. When you embrace that, the philosophy that was coming out of her mouth unwittingly, it just emasculates you, it destroys you as a person, and it makes you a follower, a puppet of the elite, of people who then, the representatives of the community, the leaders of the community, they start taking over your life. When you surrender to the concept of community, and that's what that was coming out of her mouth, and I'm pretty sure that this very kind person, if you started mentioning someone like Trump or whatever, or the Republican Party or conservatives, would just, you know, the kindness, you know, just disappear from her face, and then the vitriol and the hatred start spewing out, because these people are self-contradictory. You know, they promote tolerance and love and compassion and all that, but then when they don't get their way, and when you don't submit to this blending in with the quote community, then you are destroyed, and then all the compassion and love and tolerance just goes out the window. and they become just destroyers. Like the fire that destroyed their town, they start trying to destroy you whichever way they can. And I'm saying this, you know, as you know, what I think about Trump and all that, but Trump represent, even when he is off, you know, he, his name represents a lot of things. It's what his name represented. That's what the liberals hate. They are fighting what he represents in their mind, and not what he really is. And that's why when they hear the name, they react in this visceral way of evil, because it's not really a hatred targeting Trump. It's really targeting what empowered him to be in a position, you know, to change things. He didn't do the change, but he represents the truth seekers, and that's what the liberals hate, the truth seekers, even though Trump himself was not a truth seeker, was not and is not a truth seeker. So those were the four or five things we wanted to talk about, and it was supposed to be like a 10-minute thing, but it has drawn out a bit, but I believe there was a purpose in that. And so now that we've talked about La Hyena and the confirmation, you know, why they deserve to be burned down to the ground, and they deserve, the more casualties I hear, you know, the happier I am. I don't know how bad it's going to get, but I have no mercy whatsoever. I kind of feel sad sometimes when I see some people, you know, standing in front of the burnt houses and being interviewed. You know, the natural compulsion to feel bad for them, but no, they have what they deserve, and they enable that same destruction on our country, on the country that's dying in a few weeks. No mercy whatsoever. You have what you had coming to you, and you deserve a whole lot more. Cursed are you, Hawaii, and cursed are you for having enabled the destruction of this country, and being a willing porthole for it. So the second thing, aside from La Hyena, that we wanted to kind of emphasize, and it was a thought that hit me. It was like there, but I couldn't quite catch it. And it's until after the recording that I came to the full realization of it. And we kind of talked about it a little bit, but we're going to add a little detail. So the thing is that we had said that Thaddeus Stevens was born on April 4th, 1792. So he was born at 8 years before the end of the 19th century. And then he lived into the 19th century and dying on August 11th, 1868. And we made the comment about him being born on April 4th, which was the day that Martin Luther King died, and that he died in Thaddeus Stevens died in 1868, and Martin Luther King died in 1968. And we said there's a connection, this is all related. And the connection, the more detailed connection, you could say, is that Martin Luther King, Thaddeus Stevens felt like he had failed. And in a literal sense, he had, but it was not a fault of his, you know, that he had, quote, failed. It was the people around him who just didn't want to work with the truth that was in him. And that's why he, quote, failed, and he felt like a failure. But see, when you seek the truth, everything you do is sown. It's like sowing and sowing and sowing. And even if people reject it, even if people don't agree with it, it is sown into the ground, and it will have an effect eventually. Whether you live to see it or not, it has an effect and a consequence. And he had even though he felt like a failure, he did have a lot of influence a lot of people don't realize it, but a lot of black people got elected into Congress after the end of the Civil War. A lot of people, it was like amazing to see all these black people in Congress immediately after they had been slaves in the South a few years earlier. And this was the result of work and the efforts of people like Daddy Stevens. So there was a tangible success in a sense. Unfortunately, it was then eroded away. But even so, the effect stays. It's like eventually it comes like a nuclear bomb to effect a change. And it empowers future generations to do things they would not have been able to do. And that's exactly what happened to Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was a flawed man, very flawed. I used to admire him as a kid. He was one of my three favorite, historical figures. Modern times, shall we say. But the more I learned about him, I realized, no, this guy. And the more I understood, how his life ended and how his movement ended and all that, I realized, no, that this guy was not all that. But yeah, he had some very good qualities, don't get me wrong. But he, on the merits of his own character, would not have achieved what he achieved had it not been for Thaddeus Stevens. Thaddeus Stevens laid the foundation. It's like he provided the currency. And then Martin Luther King showed up at the bank and withdrew from that currency and used it to do the things that he achieved. If you catch my drift, Martin Luther King on his own would not have created enough currency to affect the changes he made. It was Thaddeus Stevens and Rosa Parks and all these people who rose up. They all were working on the currency of men like Thaddeus Stevens. That's why it's as if the truth said, enough of you, Martin Luther King, you're done and you're dying today. And he died. He was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. He died when Thaddeus Stevens, on the same date that Thaddeus Stevens was born. You know what that means? That means you've accomplished as much as you can accomplish on the piggybacking or on the back of Thaddeus Stevens. But because you could not produce more currency on your own, that's why I'm letting you go. It's like the truth said, I'm done with you because you can't live beyond this point of April 4th because you have not produced currency on your own and you've proved that you failed to produce that currency. You've been unwilling to do it. I've given you chances and chances, but you have been unwilling to. And therefore, you're done. And that's why he died on April 4th because he only achieved as much as Thaddeus Stevens had allowed him to achieve, if you catch my drift, or you catch the message I'm trying to share here. And that's why he died in 1968, exactly 100 years after Stevens's passing in 1868. It's not a coincidence. In other words, Martin Luther King's success came from Thaddeus Stevens. That's where it came from. Martin, he's admired a lot, but some of you may know that the guy was, he was supposed to be a minister, but he would have women come into his, when he was doing his campaigning, he would have to travel around in the South and, when he's doing his civil rights stuff, he would be in motels and hotels and he'd bring women in and he was a married man and he would, sleep with them. And then he would say that, I have to relieve stress. that was his explanation. I have to, quote, relieve stress. This is a very stressful job of civil rights. So he was a man of questionable character. When you're cheating on your wife, you're married, and you're doing that, there's something wrong with you. A lot of people who admire him, especially Christians, just go read about him. Go to the Wikipedia article on him. And the Wikipedia people have no reason to be lying about this. And I believe it can be confirmed through other sources that they say, Martin Luther King did not believe, he believed in the Bible, but only to a certain point. He did not believe in the miracles. He believed in Jesus more like a figure similar to Gandhi, you know, that type of thing, you know, kind of Buddha, kind of that sort of mindset. But he did not believe in a Jesus of miracles and supernatural things. To that, him, that was all nonsense. He was a minister, a Christian minister. It's like, I mean, if you're going to believe in something, believe in it. Don't just half, you know, half-ass it. And that's what he was, a half-asser in terms of his belief system. So he was not all that. Let me put it to you this way. There was something wrong with the guy. He had admirable qualities, I have to agree, up to a certain point. And then he just stopped. And it's kind of interesting that he didn't believe in the supernatural, given that he was a man that evoked such strong emotions, and was such he was not a stale kind of like dry Baptist preacher. He was like, you know, effusive and all that. You would think that he would be the sort of person who would be more prone to believing in the miracles and Holy Ghost stuff and all that stuff. And instead of that, he leaned toward communism. That's why he was, when he gave his speech before he died, when he said, "I've been to the mountaintop," and all that, he was giving a speech to Teamsters, to union people who were on strike. They were striking for something, and he was supporting them. And you'd go, well, there are more important things to worry about, but he believed in supporting unions. It wasn't even a white-black thing. It was union thing that he was supporting there in Memphis, it just showed you that he really was a communist at heart. He leaned towards communism. He saw it as the more perfect form of government. So the guy, and that's why the cross dresser, I forget his name, Hoover, I forget, the guy at the FBI, who had a lot of Edgar Hoover, I think his name was. He had a big file on him because they kept following him because he had these communist inclinations, and they knew about his philandering and all that, and they always had it as in a file, kind of ready to go if they ever needed to kind of expose it to the public. Martin Luther King was a very, very flawed man, and when kind of shallow, you know, when you kind of analyze him and put him to the light, you can see there was nothing, there was very little inside, but he accomplished a lot of things, but he did it on the currency that was provided to him by Thaddeus Stevens. That's why he died on the day that Thaddeus was born. Because he lived his whole life on the foundation that Thaddeus gave birth to, and after that he had nothing else to offer, and that's why he was taken away. And he knew it. That's why he said, "I may not be there, you know, with you." He was prophesying his own death, you could say, when he was speaking that day. So he could have been a great man. I mean, he had the makings of a great man. You can see these inklings, you know, these sparkles of greatness in him. Like, he could have been a transformational figure. You could say, oh, well, he was a transformational figure. No, yeah, he was transformational, but only to the extent that Thaddeus Stevens enabled him to. But on his own right, you see, the thing is, and how do I know that he really was not that transformational, you know, beyond what little that was given to him, what little he did with what was given to him? Because the very day he died, you know, in Baltimore, they had these riots, and I think in Chicago as well, and in Detroit, if I'm not mistaken, and other big cities, all these riots and looting, all these black people went out on a rampage. And you go, so that shows the legacy that he left behind. You would think that a guy who provided so much, who did so much to help black people through a peaceful movement that emphasized peace and nonviolence, on his death would promote that same attitude if people had learned from him, but instead they went and out and rioted and did all this looting and destruction to protest the death of a man who was who did all that he did through nonviolent movements, actions. So it showed that he left no legacy because he never addressed the problems in the black culture. He never wanted to go there. So he never confronted black people about what was wrong in the black culture. And that's why when he died, or he was assassinated, the evil in the black culture just manifested itself because he never addressed it. He never confronted it because he didn't want to be unpopular because there was something wrong with him. But there was these kind of sparks of sparks of greatness in him. He just never fulfilled them. It's such a sad thing, such a waste. And to avoid this completely destroying his legacy, he was taken out on April 4th. Had he lived past April 4th, I can assure you he would have just completely undone everything that he had achieved. I mean, it was like, it's like when you're playing a game and you've been winning a bit, it's better to leave the table while you're still winning, instead of staying there and losing everything. And then coming out owing more than what you started with. So he kind of came out even Stephen, shall we say, when he left on April 4th, had he stayed around, he would have soiled his legacy completely. And we would have finished seeing what was wrong with it, you know, much more glowingly, and he would have done so much more destruction compared to the good that he achieved. Okay, so now that we've talked about this, and it seems like we're not going to get to the second guy that we needed to talk about, but there's another thing I wanted to share, and it's related to all of this, believe it or not, even though it's not going to sound like it. We wanted to share an article that came out this week, and it's on thegatewaypundit.com again. It was posted on August 16th, 2023, and it says, the title of it, Mike Cernovich, if that's how you pronounce it, Mike Cernovich on Trump's most pivotal year, quote, everything that's happening today began in 2017, unquote. So they have a video of an interview with someone called Mike Cernovich. I have no idea who he is, to be frank. But he said some very interesting things, and I wanted to share them. He said in the interview, I think the most important pivotal year in modern American history is 2017. Because 2017 was the year that everything changed, and that's when all the cards were shown, and that the people who are loyal to Trump were purged systematically from the administration. So he starts talking about some things that happened, and then let me just try to read through this very quickly. It says, so let's take a quick step back. Probably here's why Steve sent you that. Not sure who Steve is, and I guess it's Steve Bannon. I'm not sure. He doesn't bear grudges, unlike me. I think he's talking about Trump. I am petty. I'm bitter. I quote-unquote turned on Trump in 2017 to 2018 because I thought, wow, we won and we're getting rolled when we control everything? What's going on? There was a website called gradian.gov, gradian.gov, gradian.gov. I have no idea what that website was about. Had never heard of it, to be frank. But okay, let me read. It says there was a website called gradian.gov where people loyal to Trump could apply to get jobs. Nobody was hired from that website. Mike Pence threw a temper tantrum about General Flynn based on that phone call that was, of course, we now know, lied about. Not sure what phone call they're talking about. To be frank, I don't care too much. General Mike Flynn gone from the Trump administration. National Security Council completely taken over by the deep state regime. One after another, Trump supporters got marched out. they would get a bad article, and including a previous guest, you'd get a bad article on them, and CNN walked out. Johnny DiStefano hired people who didn't like Trump. John McAfee walked out. Why? Nobody knows. So one after another, they were walked out. And 2 weeks after Trump won the election, 2016, of course, he said, oh no, we have no interest in indicting Hillary Clinton. Let's let bygones be bygones. So if you were making the case for Trump based on the lies that were told by the regime, you would say Trump was the most norm-respecting president in U.S. history. Tweet that out. Trump was the most norm-respecting president in U.S. history. He didn't waive executive privilege on a bunch of the old bastard-era memos. He respected that process. Andrew Kloster, or Kloster, and others have talked about that and what a mistake that was. Under the logic, according to the GOP interlopers, who, by the way, didn't win in 2016, but they showed up after we won, right? There's a good quote, quote, the strong do what they will, the weak suffer what they must, unquote. Which is why Trump is suffering. He didn't show that he was strong. He was showing that he was weak. Another quote is, people who lead the revolutions rarely end them, unquote. So the people who got Trump in, the people who went on that plane in 2016, the people who got Trump elected, were pushed aside by the GOP establishment in 2017. So he continues talking, but so the key moment is, so they start, but I don't, I think he misses, he, the guy who's saying all these interesting things or semi-interesting things, kind of misses the point. He says 2017 is when everything became undone, but he himself says it, and this is what I wanted to focus on, when he talks about Trump 2 weeks later after the election saying we have no interest in indicting Hillary Clinton, let's let bygones be bygones. So he didn't want, you know, to do political persecution of his political opponents. He wanted to be above the fray, you know, that sort of mindset. And we've shared before, I'm convinced that he made a deal with Hillary. And he said, you don't challenge the election, and I'm not going to prosecute you. And Hillary shook hands and said, okay. And he said, art of the deal strikes again. Oh, I'm so brilliant. Because Hillary wanted to, she kept questioning the elections. People forget about that, but she was an election denier in 2016. She was upset that she had lost, and she believed, oh, the Russian collusion, remember that? The Russians infiltrated the election, and they made Trump win. And for 4 years, we kept listening to the same thing, you know, the election deniers saying there was fraud and some sort of collusion or whatever. The thing is that Trump wanted to be above the fray and say, no, I'm not going to prosecute you, but I'm going to make a deal here. I'm going to get something out of this. I'm going to get you to promise me not to question the elections and not to lead this, you know, movement to challenge the elections, which I actually won, but I don't want to get into that, you know, that battle. I want to do what I need to do, but to get that out of the way, let's make a deal. I don't prosecute you. You don't question the elections. Then I'll have free time to do all the wonderful things I want to do for the American people. So he was a compromiser. He was stupidly thinking that he could engineer the success through his intelligence instead of relying on the truth. You live on principle, and then you let the truth guide you to where you need to go, and then the truth will give you wise things and innovative ways to achieve what you need to achieve, but you have to stand on the truth first. And that's when he lost. Everything that happened in 2017 that this guy is talking about, it started on that moment when he said, I'm not going to let Hillary... I'm not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton. Now he's getting prosecuted up the wazoo, and he's complaining about it. It's ironic. He's getting what he agreed not, wickedly agreed not to do to Hillary. So he's getting everything he deserves, just like the people of La Haina are getting what they deserve. Trump being indicted and all this stuff with all these false accusations and all these false litigations against him. He's getting what he deserves because he prevented true justice being applied on Hillary and being prosecuted for all her corruption. I mean, blatant corruption. I mean, she destroyed a server. She was using a non-authorized email account that was a complete violation of every, you know, bureaucratic protocol, security protocol. She was doing it because she wanted a side email address to do her side deals on a website, on an email account that was not monitored or was not monitorable by the government. So the thing is, and she did, made all these side deals with the Clinton Foundation, you know, all this corruption, just blatant corruption. And unfortunately, Trump decided, no, I'm going to do the art of the deal and not prosecute her. And he says it was 2 weeks later. I think it was that very night because he decided to go that route, because I don't remember the exact date, but I do remember that shortly after the election, might have been the night, one or two nights afterwards when he won in 2016, that a crowd was cheering and you know, celebrating the victory and started chanting, "Lock her up, lock her up." And Trump, and that was a chant that he had been promoting during the entire campaign. It was just, I think, I don't know if he was the one who created the chant or, but he would revel in it during the campaign. But once he won, he told the crowd, "Oh no, that's not appropriate. That's not how we do things. We talk now. That's not as if to say." you're being too aggressive, or I don't know what the word is, but, and we posted about this, on November 28, 2016, there's a posting on the website where these recordings are posted, and it's called "The Death of a King," and it was posted on November 28, 2016, and we talked about Donald Trump dying, figuratively, on the night before, on the 27th of November 2016. That's when he died. So in other words, he didn't even make it to the inauguration, his inauguration in 2017 as a living figure of transformative change. He died before that. And he had already decided to do the thing of forgiving Hillary. And in that posting, we talk about Miguelito Pence betraying him. And at the end of that posting, we said this in 2016. And then in 2021, you know, it happened. And we kept saying on Twitter, Pence is a traitor, Pence is a traitor. And lo and behold, it turned out, how did we know? I mean, I have never not been to Washington in decades, literally, physically there. I don't even know the people there, don't have any connections or anything like that. But I knew, and other people knew, people who were seeking the truth knew the guy was a traitor way before he had the chance to be one. But Trump didn't see it. And, you know, he claims to be a Christian. You would think that if his God is real and he talks to his God, or he has a relationship with his God and his God is real, that somehow he would find these things out. How does he not know? Because he only listens to the truth up to a certain level, and then he stops, because he says, "I don't need, that's all I need. Thank you very much. That's all I need." And then he walks away. And so he dug his own tomb when he decided not to lock her up, quote unquote, you know, and he went back on his campaign promise. And that's why he is where he is now. That's why he got thrown out of the White House, even though he won the election in 2020. That's why he's being indicted up the wazoo by all these false indictments. And interestingly, there's a hurricane that I heard about on the Pacific Ocean, which is kind of a rare thing, because we usually get the hits from the Atlantic coast, you know, these right hooks are coming in, usually come in from the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and into Florida or, you know, the southeast coast of the United States. But this time there's a hurricane that is forming, and that's been going around, traveling in the Pacific, and it's like a left hook that's coming to hit Southern California. And let me go to the article on that. And you know what that hurricane is called? lo and behold, the hurricane's name is Hillary. And it's expected to hit Southern California. It says here, I'm reading from the Gateway Pundit on an article, from an article posted on August 17th, which would be like a couple of days ago. It says, Hillary's on her way to do some damage to the Southwest. It's churning currently in the eastern Pacific near Mexico. And it was a tropical storm, but by Thursday morning, it strengthened into a Category 1 hurricane with sustained winds of 75 miles per hour. And it's expected to strengthen to a Category 4 by Friday. So that was yesterday. And it says here, the storm will lose intensity and hit Southern California as a tropical storm by Saturday night or Sunday morning. So the night that this recording is posted, hopefully, or the next morning, it's going to hit San Diego, Orange County, and Los Angeles. And they're bracing, it says here, for gusty winds of 70 miles per hour and flooding. And this is a rare event for Southern California. And Southern California, it says here, is on alert for flash flooding, mudslides, damaging winds, and high surf. And I know this is not a coincidence. Just as this story came out, you know, Mike Cernovich saying all these things, and Trump being indicted and all this in Georgia and all that. And where was Martin Luther King from? He was from Georgia. This is all tied in. Believe me, this is all tied in this very big knot. So the thing is that now we have Hillary, the Empire Strikes Back. In this case, Hillary strikes back. She's getting, quote, as some people were saying, the last laugh, because she lost the election in 2016. She was all bitter about it, but she was saying, I'm going to get back at you, Trump. And now, her party and her party machinery is getting back at Trump. And trying to prevent him, you know, being a viable candidate in 2024. And as we said, it really doesn't matter who's the viable candidate, who isn't. The country's going to be dead by then, so it really won't matter too much who is in the White House anymore. But it's not a coincidence that Hillary's showing up to hit this, you know, Southern California. It's just such an unnatural event to be a hurricane hitting Southern California. It's kind of unheard of. Well, yeah, it will, you know, become a tropical storm, but it's a hurricane right now, Category 4 hurricane, and it's going to cause floodings and, you know, hit Southern California pretty hard. And this is all not a coincidence. And the connection, I guess, to what we've been talking about, it is in part the fact that Trump was not committed to, completely committed to radical change. He was willing to compromise. You know, he sounded like a radical on his campaigns, on the campaign trail, like a person who was going to do extreme things to change, to bring change to the country. But when push came to shove, then eventually when he got there near the finish line, when he was about, it's like he had been traveling all the way to the edge of the Jordan. And when he got to the Jordan, he looked and he said, oh, these waters look too dirty. I am too royalty, too much of royalty, too much of a nobility to be putting my foot in these dirty, dirty waters of the Jordan. So let's head back and go the other way. So he turned around and did not complete the radical change. It's as if he got all the way to the stage of the wilderness, and then he had to go into sacrificial. That's final sacrificial, radical sacrifice, where you have to make radical sacrifices and say, you know, you surrender a lot of things and you go, I'm all out, I have to go all in to make this happen. That's how Thaddeus Stevens operated. He was all in, but Trump was not all in. And then he starts, let me work within the system, because he just loves, you know, that hobnobbing with people and being liked and smiling and shaking hands and taking pictures. He loves that. And he knew that if he went to the next level, he would lose all of that. And he just wanted to work within the system. And then he let all these people be thrown out who were Trump supporters. And you know, the thing that Mike Cernovich was explaining or describing. And what kind of leader lets that happen? I mean, if you are in control, if you are committed to things, and you're not just relying on people just because you like them, you're not going to let that happen. He just let somebody make decisions for him because he liked him. And this guy decided to wipe out all the people who supported Trump and put in all these garbage traitors in. And Trump didn't do a thing about it in 2017. But as I said, all of that was because he opened a porthole in 2016 when he said, I'm not going to prosecute Hillary. That's when it became evident he's done. And we were criticizing him even before that. But that was the final straw, and that's when he said, okay, he's done. He is no bueno. He is no good. So now that we have finished the introductory... let's say one more thing. I don't think we are going to get to the second fellow. But we need to mention this. It's quite relevant. I think, in a sense, even though it may not sound like it, we are talking about the second fellow. And I think that when we get to the second fellow, you will see why. I'm going to just quickly share about an article that I wrote, that I read. It's posted on noqreport.com, which redirects you to AmericaFirstReport.com, and the title of the article is Christian Publication Goes After Oliver Anthony's Working Man's Anthem Because It's Too Mean, and it's by J.D. Rucker, and I think we've shared about J.D. Rucker, my thoughts about him. He's one of those people who is very inclined to listen to the truth. He has a humble heart, but it's like he's too much in love with America, too much in love with the founding fathers and the Constitution and traditional values and traditional Christianity and all that stuff, that he just, when he gets to the Jordan, he just sees, doesn't have it in him to cross it. And he always turns around, maybe reluctantly, but he turns around. And then he wonders, there's something I'm missing. He knows that he's missing something. I know deep inside of him, he knows he's missing something. But every time he's exposed to what he's missing, he says, no, I'm not missing that. No, I'm missing something else. He keeps looking around. It's like somebody saying, you know, looking for the remote. I don't know if you've had that problem when you can't find the remote. And you look around and you look around. And it's like the remote's right there. But it doesn't look like the remote he's expecting. So he says, no, that's not the remote. It's somewhere else. Where did I put it? No, I couldn't possibly be there. Like, I'm not... That's the most unlikely place where the remote could be. So that the remote cannot be there. So he keeps looking elsewhere. And it's in that place. Just if he just moved some things around, he would see the remote right there. But he says, no, it can't possibly be there. So he keeps looking and hoping. And then he just keeps having faith. Like, oh, yeah, my belief system, that's what's going to make it happen. I just have to hold on for dear life. And then America will be rescued. And the remote that would help us all to change the channel that we're on, a terrible channel, is just stays behind and underneath those pillows. And no one wants to use it. And he's one of them. So I feel for him. I know I like him a great deal. And I believe he's an immigrant. So he's from another country. He's an injection of something foreign, but far in a good way, but unfortunately, what is what he could offer is that is foreign to our understanding, has been lost or absorbed in conservatism and traditionalism and all that, and been drowned in that, in the swamp of traditionalism. That's the real swamp, not the swamp conservatives talk about, as we've tried to describe before. It says here, everyone is entitled to their opinion, and they can write about it all they want. Conversely, we're also allowed to argue against whatever they happen to post if we disagree. And I wholeheartedly disagree with Christianity Today's recent article that took offense to Oliver Anthony's song, quote, called Rich Men North of Richmond. So apparently there's been this song that some country fellow who lives somewhere in the mountains, I guess, wrote, a humble guy, and I think the song made it to the top positions on Apple and all these other places, and they're offering him millions of dollars, you know, but he doesn't want to take the money and all that, but the song is this huge hit. I haven't listened to it. For some reason, I don't know, I just don't, I could be wrong, but I just don't feel compelled to listen to it. Maybe because I feel like it's going to promote conservatism and all that. I don't know. I could be wrong on that. And there may be a very profound song or profound message in it. But I don't know. I don't feel compelled to listen to it. Maybe I should. I don't know. I don't think so. But the thing is that there's this song that's a big hit. But it says, specifically, the author didn't like the lines where Anthony lambasts obese people on welfare buying, quote, fudge rounds, unquote, while others starve on the streets. Is it harsh? Maybe. But I believe Anthony wasn't blasting everyone on welfare, just those who shouldn't be, but are taking advantage of the system. So Christianity Today, was criticizing him because he criticized something about obese people. So let me read the part of the lyrics here, the lyrics that Christianity Today didn't like. Lord, we got folks in the street, ain't got nothing to eat, and the obese milking welfare. Well, God, if you're 5'3" and you're 300 pounds, taxes ought not to pay for your bags of fudge rounds. And then J.D. Rucker goes on to say, the story reveals the author's personal experience in the past with being on food stamps, which is why she doesn't like the song, the lady from Christianity Today. That's fine. Where I take exception is that she claims other Christians shouldn't like it either. And it says here, this is not a biblical issue just because she got offended. Again, if Anthony went after everyone needing assistance, that would be one thing. But he singled out morbidly obese people using taxpayer funds to buy unhealthy food. I see nothing anti-biblical about such a notion. And then it says here, Oliver Anthony's song doesn't rank in the top 10,000 problems this nation and the world faces from a biblical perspective. A Christian publication, an author might want to address real issues instead of manufacturing one over lyrics in a song they don't like. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this article is that it kind of points out, you know, the stupidity of the Christian, American Christian church. They're offended about, so it's again this matriarchal thinking, you know, oh, this effeminate thinking about, oh, we don't want to hurt people's feelings, and we want to show that kind of love and compassion and understanding. It's a very effeminate understanding of life, a very matriarchal way. And even as the country's dying, the Christian church still doesn't get it. Still doesn't get it. And you can see how, you know, this J.D. Rucker, who is a Christian too, is bothered by this, but it's interesting that he kind of, like, if you read it, it's almost diplomatic in the way he criticizes it. Like, oh, you have the right to disagree. It's like he's saying, you have a right to your opinion, and I'll have mine, and let's agree to disagree, but how dare you impose it on other Christians and claim it's anti-Christian and all that. So there's a certain diplomatic flavor to the comments. Instead of him saying, "Have you no understanding?" Let's say, you know, he's a Christian, so and he is openly Christian. So he could have taken like a like from a Christian perspective, and him as a Christian, taken a stance and saying, "Well, do you think God agrees with you? Do you think that you're doing the right thing by criticizing this man? Do you think God is saying, 'Well done, my young lady servant, well done for criticizing this guy'?" So he never appeals to the truth and say, "Hey, how dare!" It's not a question of whether you have a right to your opinion, and I have a right to mine. No, no, it's you are bastardizing the message that's in the Bible, the message of the God that you and I claim to believe in. Now, he could have taken that position and pounced on her and maybe even brought up passages in the Bible instead of saying it's not anti-biblical. You know, that's kind of like the defensive stance. You know, it's like when you're in American football, it's like a defensive line that holds the offense to no yards gained, 0 yards gained. Oh, there we go. It's not anti-biblical. That's what he's saying. Instead of going and sacking the quarterback and giving them a 5-10 yard loss on the play, why doesn't he bring up the fact that it's not only anti-biblical, not anti-biblical, but pro-biblical to say what this man said? Why doesn't he go there? Is it because there's nothing in the Bible to support that that stance? Is the Bible all about love and compassion and all that stuff? Or is there more to the Bible that Christians believe in? You know, I've said this before. There's a famous song called by the Rivers of Babylon. I don't know if you ever heard of it. I think it came out in 79 or 80. So a nice song. So, I really like it. But a lot of people, and it was played in discos and all that back in the day. And people would dance to it. It's a very nice beat and all that. But a lot of people didn't realize that they were dancing to a psalm in the Bible, Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we prayed. prayed or cried when we remembered Zion. And then the song ends with a quote from, I think, Psalm 19. I forget what psalm, but I do remember that Psalm 137 is kind of the core of this of the lyrics of the song. And a lot of people would have no objection to that. But I don't know if a lot of Christians would, you know, if I told them, "Oh, what a wonderful Psalm 137 is. Look, listen to this song. That's kind of what Psalm 137 says." And then go, "Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. A positive message of like uplifting, people crying out to God in their need and all that stuff." But if you read the end of Psalm 137, it says, "Blessed are those who take the children of the enemy and dash them against the stones, against the rocks." So the song starts with all these the psalm starts with all these nice things, but then it ends with these, "Blessed is the one who destroys you, who kills you, and who takes your children." It says literally, it takes your children and dashes their heads against the stone, against the stones. And obviously that part is not included in the song because that would not have gone over well, I guess, with audiences. But what I'm trying to say is that the Bible is not a happy book. You know, like, oh, you know, love it, you know, kumbaya, and just all nice and fluffy. And people say, "Oh, that's Old Testament." Well, you know, Psalm 23 is Old Testament too, and people... You know, Christians go around quoting it all the time, the hypocrites. And so it's like they just pick and choose whatever they like. And then in the New Testament, what they call the New Testament, it's the same thing. There's a lot of harsh stuff in the New Testament. I mean, we could go on for hours talking about all the harsh stuff in the New Testament. But it's always taken out all the harsh things that Jesus is quoted to have said. Harsh things, I mean, nasty things. But you know, they always pick and choose. Why didn't J.D. Rucker go on the offensive and give this woman a 5-10 yard loss and sack her? Like a defensive end, you know, sacking the quarterback and even causing a fumble and then to recover and then that's returned for a touchdown. I mean, he didn't do any of that. He just said it's not anti-biblical. Just holding the line, like, you have a right to your opinion, I have a right to mine. Is that it? So that's what I'm trying to say, is this is an example, even though it doesn't look like it, of radicalism being moderated at the end. It's all these people who get to the Jordan and just don't cross it. And I'd say the same thing about the guy, Oliver Anthony, the fellow who sang the song. He looks like a very nice fellow, very sincere fellow and all that. I have nothing against him in that sense. But I would ask him, look at what Christianity Today, a Christian publication, said about his song. What does that tell you about the state of the Christian church? And would you sing a song condemning the Christian church in America? And I'm pretty sure he would never go there. He's willing to make these critical statements about the rich men north of Richmond, and I think that means Washington, D.C., because Richmond, Virginia is south of Washington, D.C., so I think that's what he's talking about. So he's willing to criticize the people in Washington, D.C., but he's not willing to criticize the people standing on the pulpits in the Christian church, the hypocrites who didn't do a thing when all the lockdown stuff was happening and people were being mandated to wear these masks and who lost their jobs because they were not complying with the mask mandates and the injection mandates and all these things, all the hypocrites. Now, would he sing a song about that? If he sings a song about that, then I'm going to be willing to listen to it. But otherwise, I frankly, I'm sorry, I almost don't give a damn because I don't care. All that level of outrage over what's going on in the country, that level of outrage is not enough to get us over the edge, because we need to deal with root issues. The contamination of the matriarchal American Christian church is just a piece of, it's like a big turd. That's what the American Christian church is. Filthy and contaminated and effeminate. That's all it is. And it's part, like, it's like a core component of why the country is dying. Because these people who claim to have a contact with a God who is real, supposedly, and they keep claiming that they know him, apparently they don't talk to him much, or at least not enough to affect the change. And that's why we are where we are. That's why Trump is where he is. I don't know if I said this earlier, but he had no compassion when we were being harassed by all the mandates and all these things, and then the injection mandates. He promoted the injection. He did Operation Warp Speed. He kept all these people in these positions of power, the Falsies and the Deborah Birxes and all these other people, in power and influence, driving the oppression of the people. And yeah, he was against the mandate, but he never really did anything about it. Never. And so I that's why I don't feel sorry for him being harassed. I kind of do sometimes. I feel tempted to feel sorry for him, because I know what it feels to be harassed like that. But he had it coming. He'd had no mercy, and still has no mercy when it's done to the truth seekers. So let him suffer. Let him try to fight it out, that through the art of the deal and his attorneys, he thinks he's going to overcome. Let him try. The country is dying, and it's going to be dead in a few weeks. And it's because of people like him, and people like J.D. Rucker, and even, I would dare say, Oliver Anthony, the guy who sang the song, all these people who were radical to a certain point, but never were willing to be radical over the edge. And I think that, and believe it or not, that is kind of very strongly connected to the second guy that we didn't get to.
that we wanted to talk about in this recording, and hopefully we'll get to him in the next recording. But it's the same theme. Thaddeus Stevens was willing to be radical to the end, and we wanted to contrast him to another guy, semi-contemporary, or contemporary, you can say, who did the opposite, and who did not want to go all the way to the end. And that's why we are where we are. I don't know how things are going to get, but it's all very sad. There's a certain sadness in the air. I feel an environment of death. Sometimes it overwhelms me as I'm working. I just feel it, and it's just, it feels, I don't know how to explain it. It feels like being in front of a cadaver that is rotting, and you can almost smell, you know, the cadaver, the death. I don't know how to explain it. There's a horrible death in the air, and it's going to culminate in a few weeks. So we'll talk about the other fellow in the next recording, and thank you very much for listening.